From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. The journalist Bill Moyers calls caregiving among the most universal and least understood experiences that we humans have in common. Nearly 50 million Americans are in the midst of that complicated role right now, tending to an aging parent, or taking care of a chronically ill spouse, or looking after a sibling, or partner, or friend. It's a role that can be overwhelming and heart-wrenching and last for years, but it can also bring great emotional rewards and strengthen family bonds. Best-selling author Gail Sheehy took care of her ailing husband for 17 years and fully grasps the challenges and the benefits that come with the job. Today on Radio West, Sheehy joins us to talk about the caregiver's art. That's coming up after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, providing a safe and comfortable environment, investigating the latest treatments, wading through paperwork, having tough family discussions. These are just a few of the tasks someone attending to a chronically ill loved one performs day in and day out. And they do this often while holding down a paying full-time job and caring for children of their own. Caregivers are a diverse and often unappreciated group, but the work they do is vital to the people they love, and it has its own payoffs. As best-selling author Gail Sheehy puts it, caregiving may well be the most important passage of your life. Today on the program, we're talking about the challenges and the rewards of caregiving. And joining us now is Gail Sheehy. She's the author of 16 books and has been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair since 1984. She's won many awards, including the Washington Journalism Review Award for Best Magazine Writer in America. And she's also an advocate for Americans aged 50 and older. And her latest book is Passages in Caregiving: Turning Chaos into Confidence, now out in paperback. And Gail Sheehy joins us from NPR in New York. Gail Sheehy, welcome to Radio West.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. Gail Sheehy, you begin your book with an introduction to your late husband, Clay Felker. He was a legendary editor, a magazine man, and in many ways, the way you describe it, he seems, you know, larger than life. Maybe give us a brief introduction to Clay Felker.
Well, he was curious about everything. So he always wanted to know, and I remember him always walking, you know, 10 steps ahead of me, and when I'd say, where are we going? He'd just say, just, and it would be around the corner, and then the door would open, and there would be lights and music and people saying, Clay, hi, Clay. He always seemed to know where to go and where the trends were going. And he had a huge apartment that defined him. He would sit downstairs in a big club chair, and you would come in on a mezzanine floor and look down as if it were at a stage set, perfectly set for a New York editor. But he kind of lit the flame in other people, including me. One wonderful quote that I think sums up the magic that he had, it was from Albert Schweitzer. It was, in everyone's life at some time, our inner fire goes out. It is then burst into flame by an encounter with another human being. Hmm. And that was Clay.
This book, your latest book, Passages in Caregiving, is very much a tribute to Clay and observations of his strength in the face of really a lot of pain. But it is a chronicle of your journey as a caregiver as well. And kind of
and
gives,
others. And many others, others.
Many others. When did you decide to tell your story or to include your story in a book like this, and why?
Well, it was only after Clay died and I began to write, and I actually, very soon after he died, AARP had designated me as their ambassador of caregiving, and they sent me around the country to find family caregivers who were struggling, but many of them finding solutions and outwitting our very fractured healthcare system to try to get care for their loved ones without getting sick themselves, taking videos of them and then writing blogs about it as a draft of my book. But eventually I began to realize that the real problem that people struggle with is just a sense of chaos, a sense of being all alone, not doing anything right, and wondering, why is this so hard? Why can't I succeed at this most important role? And of course, the fact is that none of us are prepared for it. None of us are trained for it. We don't expect it. It suddenly, you know, rips open your life when you get the call that your mom has had a fall, or your dad has driven through a red light and hit somebody, but he doesn't remember how it happened, and you don't know if it's his eyes or his mind, but you're pretty sure you're not going to win the argument over the car keys anyway. And so it seemed very important to understand the twists and turns that this long process of caregiving involves. And I was fortunate when I was on a retreat for caregivers to walk a labyrinth, and which is not like a maze. A maze has many paths that are meant to trick you. A labyrinth has one continuous path, and it's been used for centuries. It's a spiritual journey. But it's just like caregiving in that there are sudden twists and turns that you're not expecting. And sometimes you feel like you're going backwards, and you are turning backwards, but you're revisiting a previous stage, and now you know it better and know how to handle it a little differently. Mm. So I used that metaphor for the labyrinth and tried to identify 8 common turnings on that journey that most of us will face, so that when it happens, you know how to prepare for it, you know how to deal with it, and you have all the resources there in one place with the phone numbers and the website calls to get started.
And we will certainly go through each of those phases as you see them throughout the hour. One thing that struck me as I was reading the book, you write that nearly one-third of American households has someone serving as an unpaid family caregiver. And the scale, frankly, really surprised me.
Well, it's a huge number. It's 65 million Americans taking care of an adult who used to be independent. And I've just, in today, new research by Gallup Healthways is finding, not surprisingly, that women in midlife, mid-40s to mid-50s, are really experiencing a very sharp decline in their sense of well-being. They're reporting increasing sadness, worry, sleeplessness, and they're overeating, they're smoking more, and they're getting chronic diseases earlier. And a lot of that is linked to this role of caregiving, which is often, most often, falls on the oldest daughter, and with or without, and often without help from her siblings, particularly her male siblings. And it's just simply too much to carry, because the average woman caregiver, or the average caregiver, is a woman in her late 40s who still has at least one child at home and works outside the home and provides about 20 hours average care a week for a loved one. And those needs escalate over usually a period of about 5 years.
Hmm. That's not to say that men don't have a role here. You wrote that one-third of caregivers are men. That's actually a little higher than I would have thought.
Well, it was higher than I thought, too. The difference is that they rarely do hands-on care or organize all of the many moving parts that are necessary to take care of an aging and ill parent or spouse. Usually, the men who are involved do remote care. They may work on the insurance. They may make some calls to an elder care attorney. They will often pay the bills for mom or dad. But it takes quite a bit. A family meeting, and sometimes a little shame before the men in the family realize that the woman, or even the women's sisters, can't do it all alone.
Hmm. You've written extensively about various phases of life in other books, passages as you describe them. You wrote about midlife crises and about menopause and about men's passages. But in this book, you write that caregiving is a different journey altogether. How are the phases of caregiving different from the other phases of life that we go through?
Well, it's not linear. It doesn't break down into nice, neat stages. You know, you come out of one phase, you go through a passage of disequilibrium. You don't quite know which way to go or which end is up. Then you resolve that, and you're in a nice, long phase of consolidation before you hit the next passage in life. With caregiving, it's chaotic. You go around in circles. You literally do. You may start with one crisis, and once that's put to bed and you think, you know, you're home free, and you may be for some time. It may be for months, it may be for years. But eventually, probably another health crisis will come up and hit you in the back of the head. But now you know it better, and you know how to deal with it better. And then as you move on, it's interesting that not until most women get into 3 or 4 years of this role do they call hotlines and say, I can't do this anymore. And they're just at the end of their rope. But that's because they've gone much too long trying to do it all on their own. And the very first hurdle is that most women don't identify themselves as caregivers, as playing a professional level role. They just say, well, it's just what we do as daughters or as wives or as sisters.
Let's turn to the passages that you describe. Let's start with the first one, shock and mobilization. I understand you were at the beauty shop when you got the call, as you put it. How did you react initially to hearing about Clay having cancer?
Well, I couldn't take it in. I hardly recognized the voice of the doctor on the other end of the phone. He was my husband's oncologist. And when he said, it's not benign, I said, what are you talking about? 2 years ago when you removed the cyst on my husband's neck, you said it was benign. He said, I know. The pathologist recut the old slides. It was cancer, and it's back. So we started 2 years behind the starting gate, feeling a great sense of urgency, which everybody feels in this first phase. You really don't know where to turn and who to call first and who to believe. And often you're faced with differing treatment ideas and even different diagnosis from different doctors. So it's very important to, what I say, is try to find a medical quarterback. That is, a doctor that you trust who will, you know, answer the right way to three questions. First one is, will you help us select from and assemble the team of doctors and maybe some non-medical people who can help? And secondly, will you help us call the plays? That is, develop a treatment plan. Because when you have a plan, you feel like, you know where you're going. And third, will you help deal with symptoms that come from treatment? So many doctors kind of walk away, and then you don't really know, as a layperson, how to, deal with pain or anxiety or other kinds of reactions from treatment. And if you get a doctor who will agree to those three requests, you've really found yourself a jewel, and let them know that you'll be a great partner. You'll do research, you'll report back how the patient is responding to everything, and it'll be a collaborative effort.
I seem to recall you found this medical quarterback just like the way the rest of us probably would. You started to Google. Maybe you can describe the value of the internet when you're searching for a doctor or searching for more information about the condition that your loved one has.
Well, it's very important. You can do the research, or you can actually hire a researcher. There are researchers for different disease categories, and what they can do, which is great, is go through Medline and find out all the newest techniques and protocols, experimental protocols that are being used for that particular illness. But if you do it yourself, you can. It's really important to investigate the doctor, find out how often he or she has done this particular procedure or handled this illness, and also the hospital, because the hospital may be great at cardiovascular disease, but they are not so good at diabetes or at cancer. And if the treatment involves surgery, the key number is how often does this doctor and this hospital do that surgery. The more times that has been performed by the doctor or is a specialty of the hospital, the more likelihood you will have a success.
During this first phase, you write that, you know, Clay loved to swim, and at his first diagnosis, you told them, "Honey, in 2 weeks, you'll be swimming laps again, same as always," and how a doctor chided you somewhat. Maybe you can describe the difference between cheerleading and optimism.
The doctor, who was a specialist in self-hypnosis, which helped my husband a great deal in preparing himself for surgery, or just dealing with scary times sitting in doctor's offices, he said, "You know, don't promise him that, Gail. We don't know. And it's much better that we be realistic and just talk about how, you know, realistically we've scoped out what's going to happen in the surgery." And actually using self-hypnosis was a very wonderful technique, because by giving suggestions to yourself about how you're going to feel, and when you're in the operation, not to be afraid of being pierced by a surgeon, which the body would otherwise take as being an assault, and, you know, gear up all of its defenses and tighten all of the muscles and cells so that it would take longer to heal. If you have suggested to your body that this is an invitation to take something foreign and hurtful out of the body, you're much more likely to bleed less and heal more quickly. So giving positive ways of approaching treatment, as opposed to false hopes through cheerleading, is really the prescription.
You continue to your next phase, which you title the new normal. And in this particular phase, you do describe, as you mentioned before, that, you know, there is a sense of denial that this is your new life and that you have taken on a new hat, and it's called the caregiver.
Right. And it's great if you can actually adjust to that in the new normal and recognize that you're still going to be playing that role and, you know, being on alert to notice if there are other changes or reactions by your loved one, and to get them checked out before they get more serious. But eventually, you do settle down to a new normal. Everybody else goes back to their usual lives, but you've got a new situation. And it's going to be always on your mind, and you have to start learning how to incorporate that in your ongoing life, which has many other parts to it, for sure. And not to be hypervigilant, not to be on edge all the time, always expecting, you know, another dire call. And that's, you know, that takes a lot. It takes breathing exercises. It might take some yoga, might take some meditation. But it's a tremendously important investment in the health of the caregiver, because if you remain on hypervigilance more or less all the time over a period of some years, you will suffer grave health consequences yourself.
And when you're just finally settling into that new normal, then boom, something else happens. You call this third phase the boomerang. It's a new challenge, a variation on the illness. And you write, at this phase is when you really need to create what you call a circle of care. What do you mean by that, circle of care?
Well, none of us can do this job alone. It's just not possible. And to save your health, to save your own economic well-being, and often to save your marriage and keep your kids from going off the rails because you're so distracted by taking care of another member of the family. So a circle of care makes all sense in a world. You need not only other family members, and we can talk about the family meeting because that's a key element here, but friends and coworkers and, you know, fellow gym rats that you might exercise with, or, you know, people that you knit with and or pray with. And then, as I say, not just the doctors, but the social workers and the nurses, who are the people that you really remain in touch with the most, you know, make good friends with them and be helpful to them so they'll be helpful to you and know that when you call with an emergency, they'll take it seriously. You can also find strangers may be willing to help. I recently wrote about a woman whose husband had MS. She was working full time because he couldn't work anymore, and she had to bring in the money and keep the health insurance. And as he deteriorated over a very short period of time, he went from being an ice hockey champ to being a quadriplegic in a matter of 3 years. She just couldn't do it anymore. And the community got together with her husband's input and hers, coming up with 70 different discrete small tasks that were needed to do in the course of a week. And by gosh, the community came up with 70 people who were each willing to give 1 hour a week to making this man's life full enough so that he could continue being a songwriter and for a while play his guitar and allow his wife to continue to do her job during the day and go out to participate in poetry readings some of the evenings. So if a couple like that can get together 70 people, most of us can get together maybe a dozen. But that's the key, is to split it down into very small, simple to do, not time-consuming tasks. You know, come in, move him, or read to him, or, you know, pick up some groceries, or the dry cleaning, or, you know, call the doctor back to check on the results of so-and-so. People are more than happy to help if you make it easy for them, and if you ask for help, and that's often a big stumbling block for people.
Well, you say that, you know, this person was able to assemble 70 people, but I think sometimes the hardest conversations are with your own family members. And in the book, you profile the story of the Colbert family and how one of seven children named Harriet really took on the care of her mother all by herself.
Right.
And at some point, she had to reach out to her siblings and make different arrangements. Maybe you can share some of the highlights of their story and the lessons that you took from their experience.
Well, as I say, the Colberts there were seven children, and they all lived within an hour or so from each other outside of Philadelphia. Mom was deteriorating after her husband died. She had Parkinson's. She had beginnings of Alzheimer's. She had diabetes. But more than that, she was diagnosed as failure to thrive, pretty horrendous diagnosis, which really was she just lost her appetite for life. And so she was losing her appetite for food and eating no more than a spoonful at each meal. And Harriet, who worked 60 hours a week as a medical claims adjuster, and then came home at 7 o'clock and stayed up most of the night with Mom, who would be wandering because she slept during the day and she was up at night getting into mischief. Harriet really ran down to the point where she couldn't even climb the stairs to get to her bed. And her younger sister came to help her, but even though she brought her computer and had permission from her boss to do work from her mom's home, it didn't work because Mom was always in the background saying, I want a cookie. Mm. So it wasn't until they finally sent out an SOS to the rest of the siblings saying, we can't do it anymore. Mom is going to have to go into a nursing home. And finally, their brother, Lewis Colbert, who, believe it or not, was a 30-year veteran social worker and ran a caregiving program for the county finally realize, well, I guess, you know, men can do this too, and had to jump in. And his first encounter was pretty startling. He realized how tough this could be. He went to pick up his mom at the nursing home where she was supposed to be. She wasn't there. They had transferred her to a hospital in the middle of the night without informing anybody in the family. And when he found her, she was scared to death. And he had to adamantly declare that it was unsafe to keep his mother there and that he was going to take her home. And on the way home with his mother in the car, he began to cry and pray because he realized he had no idea how to take care of a frail older woman who happened to be his mom. But he learned, and then he called the rest of the family together for a family meeting, and there were three brothers and four sisters, and everybody took a task, a day, a night, and then they pooled their money to get together a couple hundred dollars a week so they could hire a neighbor to come in and cover a couple of the other times when they were all working.
Today on the program, we're talking about caregiving with best-selling author Gail Sheehy. We invite you to join us with your questions or comments. Have you been a caregiver or on the receiving end? We'd love to hear your story. 801-585-WEST is our number, or you can send email to radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and today on the program we're talking about caring for a chronically ill spouse or an aging parent or another loved one or friend. How do you provide physical and emotional support for someone you love without losing your own identity? Give us a call. 801-585-WEST is our number. That's 801-585-9378, or you can send us email. It's radiowest@kuer.org. Gail Sheehy is with us. She's the best-selling author of many books, and her latest is Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence, which is now out in paperback. Gail Sheehy, we're kind of walking through the phases of caregiving that you outline in your book. The fourth phase is, now that you've got this circle of care that we've been talking about, you are empowered, but you start to become God-like. You think that you can make all the decisions, and you are in control. It was during this passage that you took your late husband Clay Felker to Paris, and you said, you know, the change of scenery did wonders for both of you, but that you were creating a codependent relationship. Maybe describe this phase for you.
Well, I'll describe the stage, but the trip to Paris actually was a little triumph. The stage I call playing God, it's really kind of the evolution of a good and devoted caregiver. You begin to think that, you know, you're the only one who can save your loved one from, you know, various disasters that might occur with treatment or depression, everything else. And as long as it's working, you know, you feel pretty terrific. I mean, it's very good for your ego because, gosh, you're God, you know, you're saving this person. But then when something goes wrong or treatment backfires, if you're God, guess whose fault it is? And then you go down into a spiral of guilt. So finally, I had to go to a 12-step program. And eventually somebody told me, you know what? There is a God, but you ain't it. And that was very healthy to hear. I did think that I had gone over the line when I took my husband to Paris with a feeding tube, and he was going to have this feeding tube permanently as a result of some surgery on his throat. We had been spending 6 months just eating at home alone. I had to boil down all the food and then blenderize it and strain it, so he could pour it into a tube with a diameter of no more than a dime. So it was getting pretty pretty boring eating at home. We love to eat out like most of us do. So I suggested we go to Paris and take the blender and try to do it in the hotel room. Well, after a 9-hour flight from California, standing on the curb at Charles de Gaulle waiting for a taxi, my husband was leaning on me and feeling humiliated that he had to. And I thought, boy, you are really crazy to try to take somebody in this condition on a transatlantic flight. But the next morning, I went out and foraged for a nice French breakfast and, you know, croissant and fruit and café au lait. And my husband was half asleep. I poured café au lait into his tube, and then my café au lait into his tube. And suddenly he jumped up and said, "Let's go to the Louvre." And so he was really up for it. But the end of the afternoon, I thought, well, now we're not going to spend the evening in the hotel room blenderizing food. So I took the blender, went to looked for a unpretentious French cafe, and asked to speak to the chef. And I told him our situation and showed him this blender and said, "Do you think you could do your rotisserie chicken and a vegetable and some potatoes in this?" And he said, "Oh, madame, monsieur cannot taste my cuisine? Quel dommage." And I said, "But he can smell it, and he can see it on my plate, and we can enjoy the ambiance of your wonderful cafe." And he said, "Oh, with great pleasure. Please come back at 7 o'clock." We did, and he sent out two waiters with silver trays over their heads and silver pitchers with first course and second course, and they stood there and helped Clay pour his meal. And we sat there for about 3 hours and sipping a little wine and having probably one of the most romantic and certainly unforgettable evenings of our long marriage. And at the end, two French couples came over independently to welcome us to Paris. And when was the last time that happened to you when you went to Paris?
What a wonderful memory. We're speaking with Gail Sheehy, author of Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. And let's go to the phones. Joan is with us in Salt Lake City. Joan, hi.
Hi there. My question is, I'm a grandmother, and I have a grandson with autism. Ironically, I also have an adult son with cognitive issues. So my daughter, who is the main caregiver, I am in a generational sense as well, is looking at her older brother, who she thinks is going to live with her. And then she has a six-year-old with severe autism. She cannot let go of either job, and she's really not doing with her son a great one because she feels that she is the only person and will not delegate. So when your guest said she had to have a 12-step program, I'm just curious if she can elaborate on how she was able maybe to give up some of that. It would be a huge help to our family.
Thanks very much for the call.
Oh, thank you for the call. Well, first I had to admit that I was powerless over the outcome of my husband's illness and age, and that was the biggest step of all. You know, I can do a lot to help, but I can't determine it. I'm not in charge of the outcome. And then gradually, I was introduced to the idea of a higher power. I believed in God, but the idea of a higher power to whom you could turn it over when it was just too much was of great help, because you can only do so much in a day, and more than anything, you need your sleep as a caregiver. You need to be able to turn it off, you know, an hour before, no television, nothing that's going to stimulate your brain. Have some soft music, put your legs up on the wall and lie down on your back and just let your body relax before you try to go to sleep or meditate. I learned also that I had to ask for help. You know, we think after a while that we have all the answers, and often the person we're taking care of reinforces that and says, "Well, you know, my daughter is the only one who knows how I need to be cared for, or my son is the only one I trust." And you have to get beyond that. And one of the best ways is to call a family meeting. But you have to have a mediator. It can't be you or your daughter or, you know, somebody who's intimately involved with the situation. It has to be a neutral person who knows the facts about the that your loved one's physical, mental, emotional situation, and can spell out the facts to everybody in the family at the same time, including often the patient who may be in denial about some aspect of their illness. And then to ask, what can each of you bring to the table? Everybody has a strength. You know, somebody might be good at the paperwork. Somebody's good at calling and haranguing the nurse or the specialist who won't give up the documents from some treatment. And somebody else who's good at just fixing things around the house that nobody has a chance to deal with. Because it's very important that the primary caregiver also continue to have outside activity that is meaningful and important and maybe gainful, working as much as they can, because they're going to need financial security too. Mm. And to have another place to go where they are out of the anxiety and hypervigilance of the caregiving role some portion of every day. And if they can't work or don't need to, it's very important to take at least an hour a day, every single day, to do something unrelated to caregiving, something pleasure-giving, something that brings joy back into your life. And as you move along in this journey, you have to, as a caregiver, come back before you lose your loved one. If you remain so attached and so codependent on this role as caregiver, when you lose your loved one eventually, you won't know who you are anymore.
Joan, good luck to you, and thanks for the call. We're talking about caregiving this hour with Gail Sheehy, author of Passages in Caregiving. The number, 801-585-WEST, if you'd like to join us. And we'll go back to the phones, and CJ is joining us from Salt Lake City. CJ, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I just had a few comments. Things are much better now. When my mother was ill, that was 20 years ago, and it was really desolate out there as far as getting help. Doctors didn't really understand gerontology and science of dying, at least not in my area. And I was a single mother, so everyone in the family makes sacrifices. But the small things that people do really, really make a difference. And I turned to my mother's church, whom she had really served all her life and been devoted, and they were not helpful at all. I don't know if I approached it wrong or what, but I was very disappointed, and that really affected me deeply. But one of the main things was my identity, like Gail was saying, that I went from taking care of my mother to taking care of my father to taking care of my brother-in-law, and now defining myself as not a caretaker, just taking care of me, is kind of a shock. And I hadn't prepared for retirement, although I'm 62 years old. I really haven't planned my retirement, and now without a role as caregiver, I'm trying to play catch up and plan for my own aging.
CJ, some of the points that you brought up are just what Gail addresses in her book. I mean, and some of the shortfalls when you become so entrenched in the caregiving identity, you kind of lose a sense of your own personal passions and desires.
That's why I talk about the turning, coming back, and it's very hopeful that you are doing it now. If you had known something more about this long journey, it would have been helpful if you started coming back well before you lost your mom, because you know, it may sound selfish, but you are going to have to continue on the path of life. And as you said, if you hadn't had this role, you probably would have been planning more strategically for your own retirement. It's just the loss of self that you have to bring back. And the way you do it, really, is to go back to those lifelines, those channels of joy that you enjoyed before you ever got into caregiving. And go way back to childhood. What was it that you did where time would pass and you didn't even know it? You know, was it singing? Was it sports? Was it writing? Was it music? Was it gardening? Any one of the things that you did when you were a kid, you might find an adult version of that that would revive your sense of joy and passion. And maybe somewhere in there is something that you could do outside of work environment that would give more meaning and purpose to your life. But it's very important that you get completely checked out physically. Maybe go to a homeopathic practitioner as well as your own doctor, because you probably neglected your annual health visits, and probably have neglected your nutrition. You may have neglected your sleep, and seeing people who are specialists in all those areas would be a great assist to bringing your body back, as well as your own well-being.
CJ, thanks for the call. And that is something that commonly happens to caregivers. They are so busy taking care of other people, they forget about their own health and their own social needs and their financial needs as well. 801-585-WEST is our number. 801-585-9378. We'll go to Bethany in Murray, Utah. Bethany, hi.
Hi. My question is, I live in Utah, and my grandmother has Alzheimer's in Northern California, and earlier this week, my grandfather placed her in a home because she fell, and he just couldn't take care of her anymore. It's just too hard. And I'm kind of at a loss for what to do because I can't physically be there, but I want to be there, and I want to be supportive, and I'm just beyond writing letters and calling my grandfather, I'm not sure what else to do.
Hmm. Good questions. Gail Sheehy?
Yeah. Well, one wonderful thing that technology has made possible is Skype, the free video that you can create with a computer on your grandmother's end or grandfather's end and on yours, where you can actually provide them with a little camera they attach to a computer. It's not very expensive. You'd have to have a grandson set it up. But then you can actually see each other. When your loved one wants to see you, they can dial you up as well. So it's when you're dealing with time difference, it's often helpful to have both parties be able to communicate, not just coming from you. There's also several devices that I write about in the book that allow an older person to send an email or a little handwritten note without having to deal with a computer and to receive it, so that the communication becomes much simpler, low-tech, and can happen much more often. And often just little amusing things or trinkets, just to let the person know that you're thinking about them, even though you can't be there.
Bethany, good luck to you. 801-585-WEST is our number. We'll go to Janice in Salt Lake City. Janice, hello.
Yeah, hi. After listening to the last few minutes, I've kind of changed my mind around what I was thinking about. But,
okay.
When I was taking care of my father, who has Alzheimer's, it got very progressive. So the Skype, and the phone calls weren't working. I had a brother in Europe, and I guess he found a lot of kids would come in and sing and talk to them. Sometimes people progress to a point where they're not able to really even understand who it is anymore that's contacting them. But at the same time, I would recommend for the caregiver groups, and they have them every week or every 2 weeks in most cities. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something you do for yourself. Everybody mostly vents and makes jokes and about the difficult situations that you're mm-hmm. up against that nobody else would understand, but
right. You can say what you really feel.
there aren't sometimes, if you're dealing with Alzheimer's, a lot of options at the end because right. they're so far gone. Mm-hmm. But there are options for you as the caregiver. So mm-hmm. I would just put that in. I guess I don't know what else to say.
Janice,
I'm so glad you brought that up, because there is nobody who is a better help than another experienced caregiver on a practical level and also on a psychological level, because you don't have to say very much to express what you need and what you're feeling, because they know. And especially if those groups can, you know, go out to eat together or maybe go to a funny movie and just get some R&R together around what they're sharing.
Thanks so much for that call. 801-585-WEST is our number. We'll go to Kay, who's been holding in Salt Lake City. Kay, hello.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment. I had my father, who was ill and had dementia and Parkinson's, and my comment was he was quite prominent in the community, in the legal community, and we had a bunch of people intervene, and they thought they were helping us, but in reality they fought us, and it was an interesting scenario, and it really impacted a lot of relationships. So as I'm listening to Gail speak about it, my comment would be that you would hope people support the family and understand what they're going through. And I can't tell you the people that would intervene and say, you know, you're doing it wrong. In fact, we went through legal processes and everything. And ultimately, they would offer up, they'd never really offered the exact care, but they gave advice. So that's my comment.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot, Gail.
Thank you. One of the things that I think so many family caregivers face is, particularly if there's one primary caregiver who is doing it all and brothers and sisters or friends are only checking in intermittently from some distance, you can bet that when the chips are really down and you have to make some really tough decision and you have no idea how to make it right, nobody would, that's the time that you'll get a call from the sister or brother or friend who's least involved saying, you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've tried to explore why does that happen so often. And I think part of it is guilt. Part of it is just plain ignorance. People who are at a distance really have no idea how a person may have declined, and it may have happened fairly suddenly. So they often think that, you know, you're not doing enough because they're very alarmed at a situation that seems to be spiraling out of control. And you basically have to either get them involved with the caregiving on a more or less continual basis, or tell them to just butt out. Because the last thing you need is to have somebody giving you stress who doesn't know what the score is and is telling you that you're not doing a good job.
As we're winding down the hour, I wanted to explore some of the larger implications that caregivers play in our society. Mm-hmm. What do caregivers mean for all of us?
Well, if this can be a wonderfully unifying role for families, you know, as families grow and disperse around this huge country, often siblings and parents and adult children are not very closely connected. They see each other at holidays, but they don't really quite know what's going on in daily life. And then suddenly this crisis comes upon them. The best thing to do is to have a family meeting before it happens and begin to reconnect siblings and close family around the issue of what are we going to do to help mom and dad as they get older, and what can each of us bring to the table. And if that kind of reconnection happens before the crisis is upon you, you'll make so much better decisions. And gradually, I often use this term, you enter into a kind of fearless intimacy with a parent or even with a spouse that where you may not have been close, because you're working, on life and death. And it brings you to really appreciate the moments and the good sides of each of you, even if you have been at odds before. And it can be a wonderful thing in bringing a family back together. And you'll need each other after you lose one of the family members more than ever.
Hmm. Gail Sheehy, she's the best-selling author of 16 books. Her latest is Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. It's now out in paperback. And Gail Sheehy, thanks very much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure all the way.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark, and the executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.